Watergate was not the first political scandal in our nation, and it was certainly not the last, but it was a pivotal moment in our nation's history. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It was 40 years ago this month that President Richard Nixon's top White House staffers, H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman, resigned over the Watergate scandal. It would still be another year and a half before the president himself resigned. Today, we'll talk about how Watergate changed our culture and our language. My guests are University of Iowa Professor of History Colin Gordon and English language expert Patricia O'Connor. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This spring is the 40th anniversary of the Watergate hearings, riveting drama that kept the nation captivated. Today, we'll talk about how the Watergate scandal changed our culture and also how it changed our language. With me is University of Iowa Professor of History Colin Gordon. Hello, Colin.
Hi.
Thank you for being here today. And English language expert Patricia O'Connor is also here today. She's the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language and the proprietor of the website grammarphobia.com. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Charity.
Welcome back to the show. And let's go back in time 40 years. And actually, let's go back in time 40 and a half years to get started. Colin, last June was the 40th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. And I think most people understand basically what happened. But for those who don't, let's refresh some memories. What happened 40 years ago last June?
Well, I mean, I think you need to go back a little bit more than 40 years. The Nixon administration, which was elected in 1968, for a variety of reasons that mostly had to do with the end of the war in Vietnam, developed an increasingly sort of conspiratorial and paranoid view of their Democratic opponents, who on whom they blamed the war. So as the 1972 re-election approached, the administration was engaged in a wide range of dirty tricks, had under a group called the Plumbers, because they were initially charged with stopping leaks out of the White House. The key episode was an attempt to break into the Watergate offices of the Democratic National Committee, which was a sort of comically botched job. One of the perpetrators, Howard Hunt, had an address book on him, and the police flipped through his address book, and there was an entry that said W House. And the cop on the scene said, well, it's either Hoover House or White House, and they phoned the number, and sure enough, it was the White House. The events themselves, perpetrated by the committee to reelect the president in 72, were really small potatoes. What brought the administration and the president ultimately to his knees was the attempt to cover them up. And that effort as well was, I think, animated by the same sort of deep-seated paranoia about what the Democrats were up to, and animated by the Nixon administration's conviction that it was at war. This was the end of the war in Vietnam, and it should be given leeway to fight the war as it saw fit, including on the home front.
Well, and as you mentioned, there had already been some coverage of what was going on in the Nixon administration with the Pentagon Papers had been published in the New York Times with the Defense Department's secret history of the Vietnam War. The Washington Post started publishing those papers. So there was already attention from the media on the Nixon administration and questions being asked. So Watergate was the breaking point in many ways. This was the entry point for all of those questions, for people to start getting answers.
Yeah. And I mean, the irony of the Pentagon Papers was that they had nothing to say about the Nixon administration. It was an account of the Vietnam War really up to the moment that Nixon took office. What horrified the administration and sparked their reaction was the idea that this former Democratic staffer would leak classified information. And so the sort of cadre of ex-CIA agents and other hangers-on that became known as the plumbers were designed to stop those leaks. And this was sort of Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt and that crowd. Nixon really could not abide the fact that his administration was being blamed for a war that he viewed as a democratic war and something that he was trying to get the country out of.
As people were asking questions, and of course, most famously, the Washington Post reporters were asking questions, was that the beginning of a cultural shift with how people were starting to question government?
I would say yes and no. I mean, I think the idea that everything was different before is a little bit overdrawn. And I would go back to the war as the background, that people are losing faith in a government that they feel is lying to them, not because of Watergate, but that's happening through the Vietnam era. And Watergate is intricately tied to that and is in some respects the sort of final episode of that. But I think it's more of a sort of steady erosion of faith in government, and then Watergate becomes the sort of final blow.
Before the Watergate hearings, I mean, for those of us who don't remember Watergate, and I admit that I am one of those who doesn't remember Watergate, you know, we have learned the history through political science courses and through the History Channel and through the fabulous movie All the President's Men. And it makes it seem very exciting. Before the hearings occurred, was the public riveted? Were they really paying attention to the coverage in the Washington Post and elsewhere?
I think I can respond to
sure.
that. I was at the time during the publication of the Pentagon Papers and the events in 1972 that increasingly pointed toward some sort of climax. Which came the following year. I was a journalism student. I was a graduate student in journalism at the University of Minnesota. And these were incredibly exciting times to be a journalist. As you can imagine, this formerly rather kind of boring, pedantic profession became all of a sudden glamorous. Bernstein and Woodward, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward of the Post, really became heroes to a whole generation of young journalists. And yeah, there was a lot of attention being paid to all these developments even before the hearings began. And I can vividly remember tuning in excitedly to Walter Cronkite every evening to see how Uncle Walter viewed the latest revelation that people had been arrested for this and that, or that there was actually a link between those burglars at the Democratic National Committee and the CIA, and so all of our paranoid fantasies from the 60s were coming to pass. It was an important, exciting time, even before the hearings began. But then, of course, all the revelations started to come pouring out, and then the language really picked up, the development of new language.
Right, and we will dig into that in just a moment. Colin, did you have anything you wanted to mention about that time?
I agree with that sort of characterization of the sort of unfolding sense of discovery. I think it sort of moved, largely pushed by Woodward and Bernstein, from, you know, a sort of inside the Beltway conversation, because there's a long history of these sort of political gossip columnists like Jack Anderson, who would be digging this kind of dirt, and they'd have their inside unnamed sources. But I think the efforts of Woodward and Bernstein and others really sort of transformed that into a much more sort of serious episode in investigative journalism that did, for a time, sort of fundamentally reshape the horizons of that profession.
Interesting. Well, and Pat, let's start bringing out some of these words and phrases mm-hmm. that have made it into our language. And we've already talked about the plumbers
right.
unit
Colin
of the White House.
The plumbers, and that actually that was an inside the administration term. I should back up a little bit to say that the person who leaked the Pentagon Papers was Daniel Ellsberg, a former defense analyst, and in response to his leaking that information to the Times and later to the Post, the White House Plumbers Unit was formed, and it was named, as Colin said, because its orders were to plug leaks in the administration. And the first burglary, or the first notable burglary that the Plumbers Unit carried out was in September of 71, they burglarized the psychiatrist's office of Daniel Ellsberg, psychiatrist. They actually didn't find anything, interestingly, and they covered up their tracks so that no one was aware a burglary there had taken place. That only came out later. But, of course, they so bungled the break-in at the Watergate the following June that's how, you know, a lot of this stuff came to light. So that's how the background of plumbers. And the plumbers were, of course, Liddy, Hunt, and five others who were all convicted of conspiracy, burglary, and wiretapping. And they were also called the Watergate Seven when they went on trial before Judge John Sirica in January of 73. And they were all convicted. Actually, five of them pleaded guilty, and two, Liddy and McCord, didn't plead. They pleaded not guilty, but they were convicted. As for the break-in itself, it spawned some interesting language. President Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, memorably characterized it as a third-rate burglary attempt. And Haldeman, who was the White House chief of staff, called it the Watergate caper. So caper entered the language then. Well, it didn't enter the language. Right. It was popularized.
Popularized at that moment.
Right, and President Nixon himself referred to the burglary as hanky-panky. Here's another good word, stonewall, a verb, to stonewall, to obstruct. Nixon told his aides to stonewall any attempt to link the White House to the burglary. He told his aides in March 1973, and this later came out in a tape, one of the tapes that he was later forced to turn over, "I want you all to stonewall it. Let them plead the Fifth Amendment. Cover up." And so cover up also became popular. "Or anything else, if it'll save the whole plan."
Pat, we have to take a short break, so we'll return to Stonewall in just a moment. We're talking today about how Watergate changed our culture and how it changed our language. And with me today is English language expert Patricia O'Connor. Also with me today is University of Iowa professor of history Colin Gordon. We'd love for you to join our conversation as well. How did watching Watergate unfold change how you thought about government? 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this spring is the 40th anniversary of the Watergate hearings. And this hour, we're talking about Watergate, how it changed our culture, and also how it changed our language. With me is University of Iowa Professor of History Colin Gordon and English language expert Patricia O'Connor. She is the proprietor of the website grammarphobia.com. And Pat, just before the break, we were talking about President Nixon's use of the term stonewall. Now, of course, that wasn't a brand new term at the time.
No.
And that does that date back to Stonewall Jackson?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it's probably inspired by Stonewall Jackson, who was very famous for being stubbornly defensive, especially at the Second Battle of Bull Run. So we don't know this for sure, but it seems likely that that's where the verb stonewall came from.
And so when I can't imagine there were that many people wanting to imitate President Nixon at this time in history, but when the president used that term, do you think that it entered the popular lexicon in a bigger way because he had used it?
Oh, yeah, I think it probably did. Now, he used this word to his aides in March of 1973, but, you know, the public wasn't privy to that until he was forced to turn over the tapes and transcripts were released, and then all this stuff came out. But a lot of things were emerging just during the day-to-day developments. For example, the press conferences that the poor press secretary Ron Ziegler was forced to endure. He has to be the most besieged presidential press secretary there ever was. But in April 1973, for example, the president announced that real progress had been made in finding the truth about the Watergate break-in. But earlier, the White House had denied any involvement. So when reporters were pressing Ziegler to reconcile this announcement with earlier denials, Ziegler simply kept saying, "This is the operative statement." He would just repeat that over and over again. "This is the operative statement." So R.W. Apple of the New York Times asked him if that meant the previous statements were now inoperative. And Ziegler, unfortunately, jumped on this and said, "Oh, yes, the others are now inoperative," which was an unfortunate choice of words because the president's credibility seemed to be shattered with that one word, inoperative. When you say all our other statements are now inoperative, that basically means they were lies.
Right.
So operative and inoperative, truth and lies, that quickly entered the lexicon. And a couple of other, you mentioned Deep Throat, who was, you know, famously portrayed in All the President's Men, the film. There are a couple of locutions from that film that weren't actually, didn't have any historical existence. They were just part of the screenplay, which was by William Goldman. For instance, Deep Throat, the mysterious source who was feeding leaks to Woodward and Bernstein, tells the reporters in the movie to follow the money. And in the movie, I don't know if you recall this, but he says it in a very deep voice, "Follow the money." It's very dramatic. So Deep Throat was probably the most famous whistleblower of all time, and he's now known to have been the associate FBI director, W. Mark Felt.
Right, which we learned just recently, really.
Right.
We are talking about Watergate this hour. We're talking about the scandal and how it changed our culture and our language. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Are there some phrases from Watergate that still make it into your conversations on a regular basis? You can tell us about that. Or in a more serious point, how did it change how you felt about our government? How did it change you? You can share those thoughts with us as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jamie's on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Jamie.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Oh, a couple things. First of all, I think my recollection of the break-in at Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, I think the guy was maybe Dr. Fiedler, but I'm not sure. But when they didn't find anything, the burglars actually then messed up his whole office and dumped a bunch of files out so that no one would really think of Daniel Ellsberg specifically, but... So it was pretty apparent that there was a break-in. But then my other comment about a word is, I think the phrase, the smoking gun, really came forward, because with Nixon's tapes and things, everyone was wondering, is this the smoking gun? And I think that term stuck with us ever since.
Well, that's a great one.
Yeah, in fact... the use of smoking gun during the Watergate scandal as a figurative meaning was actually rather new, because there had been in fiction, notably in first in a Sherlock Holmes story from the 1890s, someone shot someone and he was caught standing there with a smoking pistol. And later those things reoccurred in fiction, where there were literally a smoking pistol or a smoldering gun. So there was some, you know, a similar sort of wording. But the figurative use actually may have been a product of the Watergate hearings. What happened was that Nixon had been asked to turn over taped conversations about the burglary to the House Judiciary Committee, but he refused, citing executive privilege, and that was another phrase of the time, executive privilege. But in the end, he was forced to turn over those tapes. And later, when transcripts were released by the committee, Representative Barbara Conable said that a passage on one of those tapes was the smoking gun that proved the president had lied to the nation. And in fact, that particular tape was often referred to as the smoking gun tape.
Interesting. Well,
so that was a famous phrase from those days.
Colin, as you listen to Pat talk about the language, I think that it underlines the point of how captivating this was for the nation. Because, you know, we many of us use these phrases in conversation now without thinking back to Watergate necessarily, but certainly it really became a powerful part of how we spoke.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about some of the examples that have come up is that it really captures the sort of confusion of the Nixon administration and how they were going to treat this. Because when they use terms like third-rate burglary or caper, what they're trying to do with the initial break-in is trivialize it. You know, the internal argument of the administration at the time was this was no different than all sorts of campaign hijinks. It was no different than ordering 100 anchovy pizzas for the Democratic convention under an assumed name. And this is the way Liddy and others saw those episodes. But on the other hand, when, you know, Nixon decides to stonewall when he claims executive privilege, you've gone all the way to the other extreme, and the administration is really saying that as matters of national security, they need to keep all this under wraps. It's for the good of the country.
Absolutely. Well, and Penny is on the line, and she has a phrase that relates very much to that idea. Hi, Penny.
Hi.
Hi, what's your phrase?
We talked about the imperial presidency of Nixon. Mm-hmm. And I came from a long line of Nixon despisers. So when his imperial presidency collapsed, it was like Christmas every day for us. And I wondered if anybody had mentioned twist slowly in the wind.
Oh, yes, I can speak about that one.
Well, yeah, we hadn't talked about it yet, but Pat?
Yeah, some of the more colorful, spooky language came from Haldeman and Ehrlichman, who were two of Nixon's top aides. And Ehrlichman came up with this one. It was said in reference to L. Patrick Gray, who'd been nominated to replace J. Edgar Hoover as head of the FBI. He was the White House's pick, Gray was. But the White House turned its back on Gray after he let it slip in his confirmation hearings that John Dean, who was the president's lawyer, was privy to what was going on in the FBI's Watergate investigations. So he let this out in his confirmation hearings. The White House abandoned Gray as its nominee, and Ehrlichman said, "Let him twist slowly, slowly in the wind." Spooky, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really macabre.
Right.
Well, Penny, thank you so much for your call. And I think one of the great ironies, and it has been discussed many times, but still one of the great ironies of Watergate is that the Nixon administration was so secretive, but because of the Watergate scandal and the president's desire to fully document everything within the Nixon White House, it in many ways became the most transparent administration of our history, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, and certainly the fact that the administration, because of the Watergate scandal, did not have control over its papers. They stayed with the National Archives. They were opened earlier than would normally be the case. And they're extraordinarily – because of the way in which the administration ended, I think the papers of Nixon and his staff are much franker than you find with other administrations. I've done fairly extensive work in the papers, memoranda of Ehrlichman and Haldeman and others. And, you know, going back to the previous example, this is the kind of language they used. And you sort of, you know, you sort of like feel like taking a shower after a day in the archives reading their correspondence. You know, particularly their inability, unwillingness to distinguish among real and petty enemies. And to them, you know, political columnists, the Democratic opponent, and the North Vietnamese were all indistinguishable.
Interesting. Well, you know, I think about some of the information that is released slowly over time, say about the Kennedy administration. And of course, President Kennedy was much admired and died far too young. But as some of the information comes out about the administration and about his personal life, if we think about him in modern terms, I wonder how his administration would have been viewed and if many of the things that happened during the Kennedy administration could have happened under the kind of scrutiny that administrations get today. And it seems like Watergate, Nixon, was how that changed, how administrations had to function changed radically after that.
Yeah, and I certainly think, I mean, this goes back to the notion of a smoking gun. There's a certain sort of gotcha aspect to covering administration. If you can catch them in a lie, if you can catch them in inconsistency, and these are often blown out of all proportion. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think if you go back to the earlier years of coverage of presidents, they're given a fair amount of leeway, particularly in their personal lives. If we think of the way in which journalists who were well aware of JFK's extramarital affairs nevertheless didn't mention them, or the way in which journalists in which journalism avoided the issue of FDR's disability. There was a tremendous amount of self-censorship, which I think evaporated after Watergate.
Charlie is on the line next from Des Moines at 866-780-9100. Hi, Charlie.
Hi. A couple of things, or a few things. Creep is one.
Mm-hmm.
And creep. Well, let's take them one at a time. Creep. How was that used differently than it had been before?
Well, creep was an acronym for the Committee to Re-elect the President. Pretty unfortunate acronym. But that's how. Yeah, you always saw it capitalized.
The silent majority.
Yeah, I don't. I think that may have. I'm not sure that came out of Watergate. But yeah, that was. You know, that's a common political expression.
And Colin, you wanted to jump in on that?
Silent majority comes out of Nixon's 68 campaign. And it's really his response to the anti-war movement, claiming that you had a very loud minority that were opposed to the war. But in fact, the silent majority was behind the country. And this, the notion, I think, animated Nixon's actions during Watergate because he was operating under the assumption that he did have the broad support of the country in prosecuting the end of the war, which is really what he felt he was doing even in the midst of the Watergate scandal.
Charlie, you've got another one?
Nabobs of negativism.
Oh, yeah, that term was coined actually by William Safire, who at the time was a speechwriter for Spiro Agnew. So that's okay. A little bit after the Watergate.
I think that was in Des Moines that he made that speech.
I think you're right.
Saturday
Colin,
morning.
Know more about that.
Saturday morning massacre.
Yeah, that was during Watergate. It was a Saturday night massacre, I think.
Saturday night, okay.
And I can't remember exactly who got massacred or who was fired, but I'm sure Colin knows that.
I think that was the firing of Archibald Cox.
Oh.
Who was briefly the as special investigator for the committee, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Not for the committee, but at the White House end.
And then one term they used during the hearings, a technician said, it's only a Sony. He was referring to the tape recording machine that wasn't a...
Oh, that had the memorable, I think, 18-minute gap.
Yeah, although yeah. There was the theory that some sinister force erased that segment, right? The theory of Chief of Staff Alexander Haig.
Was it ever found out how that gap occurred?
Well, there is that comical picture of Rosemary Woods trying to show how she would have erased it, where she sort of stretched across her office like a gymnast accidentally hitting a pedal with her foot. but I'm not sure if we ever fully did know the answer. Arlo Guthrie always suspected that what was in that 18-minute and a half gap was his song Alice's Restaurant, which is exactly the same length.
Oh, we have to take a short break. Charlie, thank you so much for your call, and you're welcome to join our conversation as well. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page as well. With me today, University of Iowa History Professor Colin Gordon and English language expert Patricia O'Connor. We're talking about Watergate, how it changed our culture and how it changed our language. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about Watergate. This month is the 40th anniversary of when White House staffers H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman resigned over the scandal. Next month is the 40th anniversary of the beginning of the Watergate hearings that have held the nation captivated for quite some time. And as we were talking about earlier, made much of the Nixon administration quite transparent, although they had operated in a great deal of secrecy before that. So we're talking this hour about how Watergate changed our culture and how it changed our language as well. And with me is English language expert Patricia O'Connor. She is the proprietor of the website grammarphobia.com. And also here is University of Iowa Professor of History Colin Gordon, and you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. What are some of the words and phrases that entered your lexicon because of Watergate? How did it change how you think? Let us know. Bruce is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Okay. First of all, I just moved here from Ypsilanti, so it's nice hearing your voice again.
Oh, great. Always nice to hear from a Michigander.
Yeah. Well, anyway, as a side note, my uncle actually served as a juror on the John Mitchell case, and that was kind of interesting. But my point was is that how I can remember the kind of comedic irreverence that followed. Saturday Night Live first aired in 75, and I can remember vividly Dan Aykroyd portraying Richard Nixon, and he was just absolutely hilarious. Up to that point, I couldn't remember a politician, especially a president, being spoofed nationally on TV or anything like that. So I just wanted to add that just brought back memories listening to you of Dan Aykroyd on Saturday Night Live as Nixon.
All right, Bruce, that is a very interesting point. I mean, speaking of how it changed our culture, Colin, do you think that Richard Nixon is sort of the beginning of it being okay to publicly spoof presidents on television, on radio, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's a little hard to untangle whether it's Nixon that opens that door or Saturday Night Live that opens that door, because that's where much of it is vested. I think Aykroyd's impersonation of Nixon was probably predated by Rich Little's, which was a gentler version, but nevertheless picked up on Nixon's, you know, his tics and his mannerisms quite effectively. But I don't think you see the same sort of satirical attention to any previous president, LBJ or JFK or earlier.
Well, I mean, you certainly would see it in political cartoons. but not in that kind of impersonation way.
No, and not often the political cartoons would pick a particular attribute, you know, LBJ's long haggard face or Hoover's chiseled chin or something like that, just to make them recognizable. But they weren't satirizing their mannerisms in the way that sketch comedy could.
Interesting. Well, and you know, it's when you think about phrases, Pat, the political satire is the way that a lot of these phrases really enter our lexicon, even if the presidents or politicians who are being portrayed never actually said them. But I'm sure the I am not a crook. Yes. I mean, people pick that up from Richard Nixon, but I would guess also from Dan Aykroyd.
Right. But I wanted to make another point that so many of the people surrounding Nixon, as in fact the plumbers themselves, were from the intelligence community. They were spies and spooks. They were from the CIA, and I think this came out in a lot of the language of Watergate. You find it's drawn from the intelligence community, from spying, language of spying. In the 60s, the CIA's planning division nicknamed itself the Department of Dirty Tricks. And they used the phrase dirty tricks here to mean covert intelligence operations. Later on, the term was applied to any underhand political activity that was designed to discredit an opponent. And so dirty tricks were used in political campaigns and whatnot. And another term from other terms from the intelligence community that came to light during Watergate were house cleaning, which meant the shredding of evidence, laundering, which meant obscuring the source of money, and covert operations, referring to burglaries. So those terms came from intelligence, and I think, and it's because so many of the people surrounding the president were CIA people. But it's interesting that Ehrlichman came from the intelligence community, but Haldeman had been an ad man. He came from Madison Avenue, and a lot of the language that he introduced into this whole discourse has that Madison Avenue ring to it. For instance, he once told John Dean, "We have to keep the cap on the bottle." And at another point, he told Dean, "Remember that once the toothpaste is out of the tube, it's going to be very tough to get it back in." So he had an executive advertising executive's
with words,
yes,
definitely.
Way with words.
All right, let's get back to the phones. John is on the line in Washington County. Hi, John.
Hi, this is John.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
I want to talk about Sam Ervin, the senator who ran the Watergate hearings.
Yes.
And I've been in, you know, small town politics and everything else, and Sam Ervin's greatest quote was, "English is my mother tongue. Explain it to me again." I saw him on TV. He is my hero.
You know, another Ervin, a good Ervin quote was, "Why, shucks, I'm just a country lawyer." When he was facing these guys and he wanted something explained, he'd say, "Well, shucks, I'm just a country lawyer."
Oh, nice.
And, of course, he was far from just a country lawyer. He was a very smart man.
Right. Well, John, thank you for calling. And Sam in Iowa City also wanted to talk about Sam Ervin. Hi, Sam.
Hello. Yeah, my inspiration to talk about Sam Ervin, besides his name being Sam, is that looking backwards into American language, he brought out so many kind of elements of American idiom that maybe had been kind of forgotten, but they were so entertaining and interesting to me as about a 19, 20-year-old watching all of that on TV every morning. And it was great listening to all of that. So that was one thing.
Can you think of some examples?
Well, you know, he brought out, I can't think of too many of them, but one that I recall is in reference to the ways of the Haldeman-Ehrlichman gang. It seems that so-and-so moves in mysterious ways, his wonders to work, which is, of course, sort of biblical, but kind of goes back into the kind of Americana lexicon a little bit. And I think the old, you know, sort of the country lawyer aspect was that the previous caller mentioned is another one.
Sam, thank you so much for calling. And, you know, Colin, I want to bring this to you because one of the things that is also very interesting about this time, obviously Watergate was a time of disillusionment for a lot of people. But also it was a time of heroes. And Sam Ervin obviously became a lot of people's hero. Definitely Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein became a lot of people's heroes. But that's kind of an interesting side effect of this time.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's important to recognize that, you know, the congressional hearings, you know, the language and the grandstanding was important on both sides of the bench. And certainly Congress was as interested in positioning itself as it was in getting what it could on the administration. And there were partisan lines there, but there were also – the partisan lines were blurred. A lot of Republicans and Howard Baker of Tennessee comes to mind, I think saw the writing on the wall earlier and thought that they should distance themselves from the administration. And I think there was also a certain dynamic by which Congress, having you know badly fumbled its role during the Vietnam War, was belatedly reasserting its authority over what one caller characterized as the sort of imperial presidency.
Right. Well, and Pat, you were commenting as a journalism student at the time. I'm sure that people, especially thinking about becoming journalists, thought, I can be a hero.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I wanted to comment on something that Colin said. It was Howard Baker, who was a Republican, after all, who raised the question, what did the president know and when did he know it? He said this in the Senate committee hearings, and it became kind of a refrain after that. But it's true that even lowly journalism students started to think that they could be heroic in a sense. But you have to understand that investigative journalism was really it was pretty messy before the Watergate days. A lot of it was the sources were unnamed, so there was a lot of chances for corruption there.
Right.
Reporters could make things up, but Woodward and Bernstein introduced a system. They had to find out something from, I think, at least two sources, and they had to have people who were willing to back them up if they needed to use their names. Although if they had enough sources who said the same thing, they, you know, would use something anonymously. But they used anonymous sources only as a last resort. They didn't throw things around indiscriminately.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Robin is on the line next in Iowa City with a phrase that came out of Watergate that she does not like. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Charity. Nice to hear this. Makes me feel young again. At this point in time, mm-hmm. surely the most annoying phrase left over from the hearings. I think third graders were showing up at school and saying, at this point in time, I don't have my homework done. that's it. I was so tired of hearing that. Also, I wondered, who was broadcasting the hearings at that time?
Oh, you mean which network?
Yeah,
I don't remember.
Or was it was there C-SPAN where I was living at the time? I'm pretty sure we didn't have cable TV.
No, there were the three networks, and I'm
Colin,
not sure
really.
Yeah. No. By the way, it was John Dean who used those phrases at this point in time and at that point in time instead of saying now and then.
that's really interesting. I wonder if there was quite a bit of that convoluted language because, I mean, this was such a public hearing mm-hmm. and the public would have been exposed to the language of lawyers in a very prominent way, maybe for the first time.
Oh, yeah. But Dean didn't always use blah language. He was the one who told Nixon in March of 73 that this conspiracy was a cancer on the presidency. And he was fired later that month. Or maybe it was April he was fired. Anyway,
Yeah, it was April. He was fired in April, along with Haldeman and Ehrlichman's resignations. Kleindienst also resigned, and Dean was fired.
Now, I think that actually all of the three networks broadcast the hearings. They were broadcast during the day live on commercial television, and CBS, NBC, and ABC covered them simultaneously, mm-hmm. and PBS replayed the hearings at night. Before we run out of time, though, Pat, we have to talk about the use of the word gate, or a use of gate as like a suffix, because it became a suffix that means scandal. And of course, before that, it was not anything of that sort.
It did. And you know, people who are too young to know anything about the Watergate often send me questions saying, what's so bad about a gate? I hear, you know, Korea Gate, or I hear Porpoise Gate, if there's some, you know, scandal involving a porpoise. Everything has gate attached. What's so bad about a gate? Well, it's not that there's anything bad about it. It's just that the name of the office and hotel complex where the break-in occurred was Watergate. And so it became known as the Watergate scandal. So there's nothing particularly wrong with gate. But gate has now become a suffix that's attached to things that become a scandal. We had Iran gate, sometimes called Contra gate. We had,
Whitewater Gate, Lewinsky Gate.
Everything's been a gate. Everything's been a gate. But, of course, they all die out very quickly.
Right. Or most of them do, at least.
Right.
Well, we have just a moment left. And Colin, let's turn to you, because obviously there were a lot of things that changed because of Watergate. What do you think culturally has been the most significant?
Well, it's hard to say because so much else was going on at the time. I mean, so right as we're going through the Watergate crisis, the United States is running its first trade deficits, its first sustained fiscal deficits. It's starting to rethink its commitment to expansionary social programs. Inequality is beginning to widen. And so I think, the interesting counterfactual is, you know, we proceed from the assumption that people lose faith in their government. But my sense is they would have lost just about as much faith if Watergate hadn't happened, that government was in the view of many, just not delivering in the way it used to.
Interesting. And Pat, I mean, obviously it had a huge impact on our language.
Yes, it did. And I think it also brought a skepticism about language to the general public, whereas at one time, a presidential address was pretty much believed lock, stock, and barrel, or at least you gave the president the benefit of the doubt. I think now people examine things. They pick them apart. And again, as Colin said, maybe that skepticism would have happened anyway. But I think the fact that there was all this obfuscatory language tossed around at the time, and so much of it proved to be either hot air or outright lies, I think that encouraged people to doubt things that came out of public discourse. They just doubted administrative statements.
Pat, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
English language expert Patricia O'Connor. She is the author of Woe Is I and a number of other books about the English language. And her website is grammarphobia.com. And Colin Gordon, thank you so much.
Sure.
Colin Gordon is a professor of history at the University of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, the history of the Iowa State Patrol. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.